Congressional district's boundaries have shifted since Bowman first won office in 2020, losing most of its sections in the Bronx and adding more in Westchester County suburbs. Nationally, Democratic Party leaders have emphasized moving towards centrist candidates who might fare better in suburban races. I'm Scott Baba for Pacifica Radio.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features the African University, the politics of knowledge and access. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Wiza Muntali. The music in the background is Teacher Don't Teach Me Nonsense by Fela Kuti. Today's Africa Now's discussion with Professor Paul Zeleza is from our archives. The discussion dissected the history of universities in Africa from ancient times to the current. The conversation also highlighted the production and control of knowledge on the continent, investment in learning institutions, and the ever-increasing labor source. Dr. Paul Tiambe Zeleza is Senior Advisor for Strategic Initiatives at Howard University. Previously, he was Associate Provost and North Star Distinguished Professor at Case Western Reserve University from 2021 to 2023, after serving as Vice Chancellor or President and Professor of the Social Sciences and Humanities at the United States International University in Kenya from 2016 to 2021. Professor Zeleza has held distinguished academic and administrative positions worldwide on three continents and the Caribbean region. He has been widely published in books, journal articles, and author of two collections of short stories and an acclaimed novel. Several of his books have won international awards. His forthcoming books include Reenvisioning African and American Universities and The Chronicles of African University Leaders, a volume of reflections by former vice chancellors of some of Africa's leading universities. Professor Paul Tiambe Zeleza has received numerous awards from major universities for his scholarship. Here is Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope with the conversation with Dr. Paul Zeleza.
Thank you for taking the time to join us today, Professor Paul Zeleza. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, and thank you for asking me to join you.
No, this is absolutely, there are certain instances that we mark in our lives, and certain instances, this is one of those highlights, being able to be engaged in a conversation at this particular juncture in our historical epic is to engage in a conversation about the African university and its future, its past, its present, but its future in the context of a global society, a global world that is in absolute chaos, to be able to think with you in public out loud is just one of the highlights of my life. And I'm glad we're actually being able to share this with the public. Again, thank you for, obviously. And of course, as we were talking before, there's so many connections that we have, and that's the way that it usually happens when you're doing work, particularly for Africa and the African world, you're doing a specific type of work, quality and work that is really critical. The connections are very, very close. They're closer than we think. And so with that being said, again, thank you for joining us. And let's jump right into the conversation, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
This notion of the African university, and it's very important in the context of this time, the context of education, the context of recolonialization and imperialism that is being, kind of rebranded in some ways, but still old in other ways. Let me just put this broad question to you. Is the university, as a Western construct, beneficial to the current and future needs of continental African communities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. That's a very, very good question and very complex question. First of all, I think the university itself, we need to unpack it because there is a tradition of higher education on the African continent, which goes back many centuries, in some cases more than 1,000 years. And what we have established during the colonial era is not the first time that you're getting higher education. So the issue of contextualization of what is the university is extremely important. So some of the world's oldest universities, as we know, in Africa, the Izituna in Madrasa, established in Tunisia around 732. Then you have, of course, the University of Karawini, forgive my pronunciation, in Fez, Morocco, 1859, founded by a woman, Al-Fahiri. And that university, of course, attracted students and scholars from Andalusian Spain to West Africa. Then, of course, we know the establishment of Al-Azhar in Cairo, almost the same year that Cairo was being established. And that university, those three universities are still in existence. Al-Azhar is one of Africa's largest universities today, with more than 300,000 students. And then, of course, you also had the University of Sankore in West Africa, established in the 12th century. Unfortunately, that one hasn't survived, but we know from the historical records that taught a lot of subjects that were popular at that time: theology, logic, astronomy, astrology, grammar, rhetoric, you name it, history and geography. And it's important to understand the legacies of this tradition for Africa and for the world. So as I noted, these universities still exist, at least three of them still exist. And more importantly, we have also seen in recent times the establishment of Islamic universities that in some ways are patterned or modeled on these ancient Islamic universities. And then thirdly, it's important to understand also that what we call the Western University that was introduced in Africa in the 19th century bore a lot of Islamic influences. So for example, a lot of the knowledges, as we know from history, that are going to be integrated into the European knowledge system and the universities were really inheritances transmitted by Muslims, many of them from Africa. So a huge corpus of knowledge, rationalism, the investigative approach to knowledge, the elaborate disciplinary architecture of knowledge, and notions of individual scholarship and the idea of the college. All of these, which became very central features of the European university, were really inherited from the Islamic university, from the Muslim scholars that were part of European history from the 8th century. So we need to, as I said, to unpack the notion of the university. Obviously, during the colonial period, we are going to have a new architecture of higher education introduced in some of the colonies that bears the imprint of the European traditions. And then, of course, after independence, some of these, a lot of more universities are going to be established. What I find interesting when you look at the history of higher education in Africa is how limited higher education was during the colonial period. So in 1959, the year before, 1960, the year of African independence, because so many countries got independence in that year, 17 of them, there were only 76 universities on the entire continent. The majority in South Africa and Egypt. And then you had a scattering in Liberia College, of course, established in the 19th century, and one of its principals was one of the great Pan-Africanists, Edward Blyden, and of course in Sierra Leone, and so on. But, there were very few universities. A lot of them are being established towards the end of the colonial era. So Makerere, Legon in Ghana, Ibadan, in Nigeria, Khartoum. They're really sort of products of the post-war period as part of decolonization, when the colonial state needed more educated people than was the case prior to that. And it was also an answer to the agitation of the nationalists for higher education. And it was a soap, as it were, to satisfy them. But the point is that there were very few universities. So the real, if one was to use this term, the golden period of higher education in Africa comes after independence. That's when the bulk of Africa's higher education institutions are established. The number increases from 76 in 1960 to 294 by 1979. And then by 1999, you have 784 universities. And by last year, you had 1,690. The majority by then, last year, were private. So the issues have been, in my view, that the colonial universities, like the colonial economies, were extroverted in that they are physical, they are organizational, they are administrative, and their disciplinary architecture was modeled on the imperial metropole. They were, in other words, really branch campuses of metropolitan universities. In fact, a lot of the new British universities, Makerere, Ibadan, Legon, and so on, were really affiliated with the University of London. And then the post-colonial universities, their challenge has been, how do you indigenize and at the same time maintain international connections? So that really is the big question that these institutions have been dealing with. And we can follow from there. But thank you for that question. I thought it was excellent.
No, and this is a very important contestation which you just actually laid out, this indigeneity, the indigenizing, at the same time being able to, maintain a international connection, right? So this is a very important, could you speak a little bit more about that particular challenge? Because to me, it seems like there's the curriculum question in the context of the colonial curriculum, but also there is a labor question in the context of global economy. There's a resource extraction question. So what you just laid out are multiple things. Could you talk a little bit more and expand upon that indigeneity, that indigenization, and the importance of knowledge? Because you just laid out a history of knowledge already being in the continent.
Yeah. So absolutely. There are multiple layers, so multiple angles in which you can look at this question. One is exactly what you just said. And that is the curriculum. How do you have a curriculum that is responsive to the needs, the challenges, the problems, the aspirations, the opportunities, the visions of African peoples in their different locations, in their localities, in their nations, in their regions, and of course, continentally, and for me, globally, including the African diaspora. So how do you have a curriculum that responds to their historic and contemporary realities, and in terms of research, address the challenges that they face in their multiple social and spatial abodes. So those are big questions. And in addressing those issues, you obviously have to use methodologies and be inspired by values and visions that are pertinent, speak to the African peoples. So in terms of the curriculum, certainly you in the social sciences and humanities, where the contestations are particularly strong for obvious reasons, you're studying us as human beings in particular locations with particular histories, and the ways in which you understand the methodologies you use, the theories that you use, the perspectives you use, will of course influence the kind of analysis and interpretations you're going to have. So there is a lot of intellectual contestations over methodology, over theory, over perspective. And there are also, of course, going to be contestations over the ways in which this knowledge is packaged for education, namely teaching, and how it is packaged in terms of policy, for our governments, our civil society organizations, for our international and intergovernmental organizations. And it's therefore important for African scholars and African educators, both on the continent and in the diaspora, to really face squarely these challenges. There are epistemological challenges. There are also fundamental ontological challenges. What does it mean to be, to become, and to live as a person of African descent? So there are philosophical questions, there are political questions, there are ideological questions, there are intellectual questions, and therefore the contestations over the curriculum is going to continue. It's been there for a long time. What I think we have to do more consciously is really to educate ourselves as people of African descent intellectually about the different African, what Mudimbe used to call, V.Y. Mudimbe called the African libraries. There is a tendency, which is unfortunate but understandable, to assume there is one African tradition of knowing, of knowledge production. There has never been and there will not be one. There will be multiple ways of knowing, multiple ways of constructing knowledges. And in Mudimbe's construct of libraries, to use that concept, one could argue that there have been at least four key libraries in Africa's intellectual history. The first library, in terms of identifiable library, body of knowledge, is for lack of a better term, the Christian library, which goes back to the beginnings of Christianity. People forget that some of the key church fathers, key theologians, key thinkers in the construction of Christian doctrine were people from the African continent, St. Augustine and so on. And that library is extremely important for us to understand its development, its legacies. And secondly is the Islamic library, which I talked about briefly with regards to the Islamic universities. This is a huge body of knowledge that has been going on for at least the last 1600 years. And then, of course, you have the third library, which is, for lack of a better term, I call it the griot library, what some people call traditional. As a historian, I'm reluctant to use the word tradition because the issue is tradition at what point in time. Is it the 19th century? Is it the 15th century? Is it the, 5,000 years ago? So, that griot library, of course, has been, it is very complicated in its own ways, and it has its own sort of knowledges and protocols of creating and constructing and remembering and disseminating the knowledges. And then, of course, you have the colonial library, which comes in with colonial education and so on and so forth. And a lot of us are really hung up on the colonial library, and understandably so, because it's so immediate, it's so recent. But in terms of intellectual histories, I think it's important to realize this is just one of other libraries in Africa. And our challenge, frankly, is how do we really understand these libraries in all their diversity, their complexity, and even contradictions, and then construct empowering knowledges for 21st century Africans on the continent and in the diaspora. So the issue of curriculum, the issue of knowledge production, and the issue of dissemination of knowledges is really a critical part. It's not just a question of sort of counterposing indigeneity as one construct versus foreignness or coloniality as another construct. It's a lot more complicated than that. And I think we need to try to engage these complexities. But of course, at the school level, it means that we have to try to write textbooks that show our students, our young people, the complexities of Africa's intellectual traditions in ways that make sense, of course, to different age groups, and that are empowering. Taiwo, the philosopher in Washington D.C. there. Recently wrote an essay which is very interesting. The very way we construct the periodization of African history, pre-colonial, colonial, and post-colonial, is extremely dangerous. Because what it does is posit the colonial as the central feature of our existence. As Ajayi, the Nigerian historian, put it in the 1960s, the colonial is a parenthesis, is a footnote in the long history of Africa and Africans. And obviously, it's the most immediate, and it's understandable why we focus on that. But I think we need to engage in long-durée histories to understand that the colonial, of course, was important, but it's not the sum total of our being as human beings on that complicated continent called Africa. So I have a very conflicted relationship with notions of coloniality as determinants of everything about us, and therefore positioning decoloniality as the primary instrument of trying to deal with that reality. I think our reality is a lot more complicated than that.
No, and you raised a very, very important point, this notion of the decoloniality, efforts to recover, identify and recover, but also knowledge production in the context of a time construct that arrests the way that we think about ways of knowing, and which is in this context of a coloniality, to arrest at the human in a particular point. But that comes with the processes of control. In order to control someone, you have to freeze them in a particular point, define them, and then set them on a stage. You could speak a little bit more about the decoloniality and the importance of that. It's also a rejection of a time construct and the way that knowledge is produced, because you also talked about the embodied knowledge that is that the libraries, right? The saying that when an elder dies, a library dies with them, those types of things. You talked a little bit more about some of the efforts. I know that you have been very, very involved in a lot of, decolonizing and also really kind of, situating a Pan-African university concept that I would probably kind of determine and that hopefully we'll be able to talk about. But talk a little bit more about those efforts to decolonize. Of course, we had the Fees Must Fall movement at one particular point, the Roads Must Fall. Mm-hmm. So there are some efforts. Could you talk about the history of that decolonizing efforts coming out of the anti-colonialist movement? And then we'll kind of move forward to posit our question in this time construct, this frozen time construct.
Right. Yeah, so maybe a couple of ways of approaching that question. First of all, just to, map out how knowledge is produced. What are the dynamics of knowledge production? And for lack of a better, way, architecture of doing this, I tend to talk of the four I's of knowledge production. One is, intellectual traditions. And therefore, that's why it's important, in my view, to immerse ourselves in intellectual traditions of Africa. And also, as part of that agenda, to immerse ourselves in global intellectual traditions. And of course, Africa has been engaging not just with Europe, but with Asia for a very long time. And therefore, and certainly now, in terms of Africa's global engagements, Asia has become extremely important. China, for example, is Africa's biggest trading partner now since 2009, after having replaced the United States. And therefore, it's not just knowing our multiple intellectual traditions and multiple global intellectual traditions, including the European one, but also other traditions. Because we are a global people, we should not be reduced to a people who have simply been, confined to one space. We know, of course, that's not true. But also, we know it's not true that the modern connections between Africans and the rest of the world are not products of the European moment. Africa has been relating with Asia, for centuries before Europe became the center of the global world system. So that's the first thing, the intellectual tradition. The second is, of course, institutional dynamics. The institutions, how they are constructed, how they are funded, how they are governed, how they produce, and employ, knowledge producers, matters a great deal. And therefore, this requires us to understand what are the challenges facing knowledge producing institutions occupied by peoples of African descent on the continent as well as outside the continent, because that will determine the kinds of knowledges, the kinds of opportunities, the kinds of dynamics that impact the knowledges that have been produced. You know, just a simple example. In certain institutions, we see it in this country now. Even talking about critical race theory is supposed to be criminal, because there are a lot of political interests in trying to obfuscate understanding of how this country really operates. And that is sometimes internalized in institutions through governing boards that begin to impose certain conditions in employing certain faculty. So those institutional dynamics are extremely important to understand. And thirdly is ideological dynamics. The example I just gave is part of an ideological dynamics that gets infused into institutional dynamics. And the ideologies that reign at a particular time are going to influence the ways in which we do scholarship. So before feminism was the kind of movement that it became in the 1960s, 1970s, and later on, studying women, whether in sociology or history or literature, was not an important aspect. And then with feminism and the entry of more women into institutions of higher education, they begin to ask, why are we not there? Why are we silent? Are we silenced in these texts? And therefore, the challenge to androcentric studies in the humanities and social sciences began to be mounted by feminist scholarship. It was a product of the feminist movement, and which then affected how research is being done, just like the civil rights movement in the United States and then the nationalist movement in Africa led to the studying of African peoples in ways that was not conceivable before those movements became what they are. So the ideological dynamics need to be understood as well. And then finally, it seems to me there is always the fourth eye, that is the individual dynamics. All of us as scholars are inscripted by our various biographies, social biographies, our gender, our race, our nationality, our religion, our proclivities, whatever it is, influences the kinds of scholarship that we do. In fact, fundamentally, if you really dig deep into why people choose certain topics in their study, it is really connected in very profound, sometimes unconscious ways to their own social biographies. So all those forces come together to influence the kinds of knowledge production. So when we are doing sort of an archive of an archival analysis of knowledge production and the debates and the contests that have erupted, we have to understand the interplay of these four forces, in my view. Now, it's not surprising that in the 1960s, even the nomenclature, the language we used, in the 1960s and 70s, we used the term decolonization. It's interesting that we are now using the terminology decoloniality, and it's emerging out of a particular historical geography, a historical geography of post-apartheid South Africa, in which these issues are extremely potent because they are part of the post-apartheid dispensation. Now, those of us from the other parts of the continent, of course, we battled similar questions, but we did not use that terminology, decoloniality. We called it decolonization. And Tandika Nkandawire, who I'm sure talked about the five historic agendas of decolonization. And this was a sort of a multi-pronged agenda. One, of course, was decolonization of independence, rather, of the Pan-Africanist movement, the nationalist movement. One was decolonization in its multiple iterations, economic, political, intellectual, existential, if you will, and so epistemic and existential. And then, of course, nation building. How do you build a community of people in a certain historical geography called a nation state? Infuse the states that were colonially created with a sense of nationhood. Again, a very complicated agenda. And then thirdly, of course, the whole question of development, which has been the preoccupation of African elites and African people's material well-being. And this, of course, speaks to how they were deprived during the colonial period and the struggles to overcome the huge backlog of material underdevelopment, starting with the slave trade, with colonialism, and of course, later on with neo-colonial regimes. And then the issue of democratization, the issue of empowerment, the issue of inclusion, the issue of participation, the issue of belonging to a community, a polity, however you designate that polity at an institutional level, to what extent are our institutions authoritarian or democratic in terms of governance? To what extent are countries authoritarian, and so on and so forth? So that issue of democratization, not simply at the political level in terms of the state, but also in terms of organizational politics, including universities. And then, of course, the whole issue of regional integration, of Pan-Africanism, and so on and so forth, in which to what extent are the knowledges we're trying to produce, the systems we're trying to produce, speaking not only to our local realities, wherever we are located, but also speaking to the needs and interests in solidarity with other peoples of African descent elsewhere, on the continent as well as abroad. So for me, the decolonization agenda that people like Tandika Nkandawere talk about, and some of us talk about in our works in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, is extremely important in the debates on decoloniality, which sometimes, and it's not necessarily because, people are trying to be restricted to a particular moment, which of course you expect them to be. But sometimes I worry that some of these debates do not tie to earlier debates, which are very, very old in the pantheon or in the archive of African thought. I always encourage my students to read, your Blydens, your Douglases, and so on and so forth. You find that a lot of the issues we're dealing with today were issues that our ancestors, intellectual ancestors, in the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries worked on. So one of the things I would like to see is much more contextualization, much more connectedness of these debates, fees must fall, and decolonizing knowledges in a post-apartheid South Africa with those debates, earlier debates on decolonization of the continent in its multiple dynamics or dimensions of coloniality and colonization and so on.
You're listening to a portion of a conversation from our archives with Dr. Paul Zeleza, who is Senior Advisor for Strategic Initiatives at Howard University. The discussion dissected the history of universities in Africa from ancient times to the current. The music in the background is Abyssinia by Tandi Netuli. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation with Dr. Paul Zeleza and Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope.
And that's one of the things that I try to center, a lot of the work that, I do myself, but also the collective in the context of the African Women Project. And also there's an access issue here too with, these conversations. Could you talk a little bit about the access to these collaborative, because we're doing it right now. right? And I'm, you know, and it's this creating a way of thinking, informing and recovering and talking about, you know, historic, but also trying, you know, having a conversation about the moment now and thinking towards the future. Mm-hmm. There are these pockets. There should be obviously more collaborative, particularly with our comrades and colleagues on the continent of Africa in institutions and outside of institutions as well. I think that's important. One of the things, once we talk about, as we move to access, I couldn't help but think about the way that the individual is defined and how it's contextualized in Western European thought that comes into contradiction to the forms and ways of being, the forms of knowledge and the ways of being on the continent of Africa as well. So what about that extraction of the individual, right? This you know, students are going to school for their individual,
right?
You know,
yes.
So economic advancement. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes. So first of all, in terms of, I think you're absolutely right in terms of pockets of access. So the issue of access, and that's why the Fees Must Fall movement is extremely important. It is talking about the, you know, how many people really have access to higher education. That's the first question. Connected to that, of course, is the question of affordability. How many people can really afford higher education? And connected with that is the issue we've been talking about: what kind of education are they exposed to? What kind of values is that education giving them? Are they, those values ones that will empower them as individuals or empower them as members of communities and society and provide a collective basis for transformation of our societies? Now, on all of these, you know, there are severe challenges. If you don't mind, let me share with you some data. Because I've talked about these issues in many forums. So in terms of access to higher education, it's extremely limited on the African continent. So, you know, I don't use in my own work sub-Saharan because I think it's a Eurocentric construct. But, you know, a lot of the international data tends to talk about that. So in sub-Saharan Africa, enrollment ratios for tertiary is about 9%. So 9% of young people aged 18 to 24 go to universities. In North Africa, it's about 33%. If you combine the two, it's about 14%. 45% of tertiary students on the African continent are in North Africa. The world average is 38%. For the developed countries, it's 77%. For a country like South Korea, which is used as to beat Africa up, because they, you know, people argue South Korea was developmentally similar to many African countries in 1960, but now it has left the continent behind. South Korea is 96%. So there is a huge backlog of inaccessibility to higher education on the African continent. So there is definitely a profound need to expand access, to grow the number of higher education institutions. So that's simply one reality that we have to grapple with, that not enough young people are getting access to higher education. And that has all sorts of implications for the continent, in terms of the development of human capital, in terms of taking advantage of the youth bulge, turning it turning the explosion of the African population into a demographic dividend. Africa is in a very interesting moment historically. It's for the next three decades, if not for the rest of this century, we are going to have the world's largest labor force. That's a huge asset. But for that asset to be realized, there is need for skilling that asset, educating those young people, providing them high quality education. So, you know, and that's a developmental boon that cannot be wasted, should not be wasted. The other issue is, even the ones who can go to college, how many of them have resources to pay the access question? And what has happened since the 1980s, the turn of the 1980s, not only just in Africa, but across the world, including the United States, is the neoliberal agenda in which education has been turned, was turned from a public good into a private good, in which the cost of education increasingly falling on the heads of students and their families, and no longer the state. You can see that story in every country, the United States, Kenya, you name it. And this also means that kids from poor backgrounds, peasant backgrounds, working class backgrounds, lower middle class backgrounds, find it extremely difficult to get education, higher education. And I've done a lot of research on funding of higher education, and it really breaks your heart to see how the state subvention, whether you're talking of the U.S. or African countries, per student has progressively declined over the last 3 decades. Recently, last week, or 2 weeks ago, the budget in Kenya for higher education was reduced by 20%. It was already very low and not able to support this institution. So the issue of financing these institutions, which in turn affects who has access and who can afford, is extremely important, and we have to deal with that issue. And then, of course, the other issue is access to knowledge that is already there. But before you even talk about access to knowledge that is already there, which involves, how many journals can you subscribe to in your libraries? Before you talk about that is, production, access to the production of knowledge. And in this area, again, we are not doing very well. There are huge discrepancies. In 2019, the latest figures show, we have the latest figures for 2019, only 3.5% of global knowledge scholarly production was coming from the African continent. Only 3.5%. This is less than Canada with 3.6%. And Asia, which is now the world leader in knowledge production, is 48%. So we need to build, strengthen, enhance, whatever word you want to use, our research infrastructures, research resources, to enable our students, our faculty, and our institutions to produce knowledges that address the pressing issues, the pressing challenges, the aspirations of African peoples. And this then also translates into the whole question of the access to the knowledge that is already there, being produced elsewhere. And what has happened in the last 30, 40 years is very very concerning. And that is the ways in which knowledge has become increasingly proprietary. And a lot of us publish in these so-called prestigious journals. All of them are behind paywalls. And of course, as you know, there is a movement, the open, open knowledge movement, open access movement, to make that, knowledges which are funded by governments, funded by universities, funded by all sorts of agencies, to be readily accessible. And there's been a lot of resistance by these big, huge, multinational companies that are in the knowledge business. That's another issue that we have to deal with. And all these dynamics lead to a situation whereby the opportunities for circulation of ideas, circulation of knowledge, become severely constrained. And this, in my view, calls on us to do a number of things. One, is to strengthen our own outlets. So I'm a very strong advocate for creating and publishing in outlets that our intellectual communities have control and make no apologies about it. Obviously, still doing whatever rigorous standards review that are required for, you know, credible scholarship. But that agenda of creating, controlling our own spaces of knowledge production is absolutely imperative. Secondly, it's also useful, and your program is an example of that, of creating forums for the dissemination of knowledge to the general public. Because not everybody goes to university festival, and even if they do, they are not necessarily studying the kinds of questions that will affect their life when they're working and when they're living and when they're engaging with people. So we need outlets, broadcast outlets, online outlets, all these outlets that with the digital revolution, make possible, use them to really disseminate knowledges that are not readily accessible sometimes in the formal educational system. And then thirdly, it's important in my view for us to be very intentional in creating research teams that are transnational, that involve a community of scholars that are not only like-minded in terms of discipline or interdisciplinary approaches, but that fundamentally, in terms of epistemology, they are and ideology interested in the agenda for the empowering, for the liberation, for the emancipation of African peoples. And one of the things I'm very, very keen on is ensuring that we have collaborative engagements between African institutions and HBCUs, for example, in this country, between African-American academic communities and African academic communities to create this kind of epistemic culture that is Pan-African. And in that regard, I'm involved in two projects which may be of interest. One is a program, we established the Carnegie Corporation of New York. I did research for them in 2011, 2012 on how African-born academics in Canada and the United States engage with African higher education institutions and research networks. And out of that project, we established the Carnegie Corporation, the Carnegie African Diaspora Fellows program that sponsors people from Canada, African-born academics from Canada and the U.S. to go to Africa. So far, we have sponsored more than 500. We've given more than 500 fellowships to more than 150 universities in six. We expanded to 9 countries 2 years ago. And 2 years ago, I and a group of friends, we created what we are calling the Consortium of African Diaspora Scholars Programs, which is registered in New York. We registered it in New York and registered it in Nairobi to provide a forum, a platform for engagement between the African diaspora as a whole, not just the African born. So African-Americans, Afro-Brazilians, Black French, Black British, you name it, to engage with African research networks, African universities, African organizations interested in knowledges of whatever type. It could be private companies, it could be NGOs, it could be civil society organizations, it could be universities, it could be anything, to mobilize this huge asset of the diaspora as an intellectual resource. We all know the diaspora is Africa's biggest donor in terms of remittances. 2 years ago, it was $84 billion, more than ODA, Overseas Development Assistance, more than the EU gives, more than the US, more than China, more than foreign investment, is the diaspora. And I believe very strongly the diaspora is Africa's biggest intellectual resource outside the continent itself. And we need to mobilize that. and through that mechanism, really strengthen, capacitate African institutions of knowledge much more than they are able to do by themselves. And also it leads to a way of internationalizing Africa in ways that are truly transformative, because I believe that the diaspora is really the eyes and ears, the global eyes and ears of Africa. And you know, whatever differences may exist, there is a commonality of interest in our global condition, in our fate on this planet.
Which brings us, as we kind of, I can talk to you all day, and I'm sure our listeners can listen to you all day, but in the sake for time, but also in the sake that we obviously will bring you back. You just did, what you are outlining here as, I want to make sure that we make these connections for our listeners. You gave a very important, data point that Africa, the continental Africa, will have the largest labor population, right? Mm-hmm. And so what you're actually also laying out is the fact that, you know, this is a historical continuum, and how does this look in the 21st century? We have an opportunity to control.
Yes.
We have an opportunity to control using the proper frameworks and methods and means to do that.
You've just been listening to a portion of a conversation from our archives with Professor Paul Zeleza. In the conversation with African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope, Paul Zeleza dissected the history of universities in Africa from ancient times to the current. The conversation also highlighted the production and control of knowledge on the continent, investment in learning institutions, and the ever-increasing labor source, and more. Dr. Paul Tiambe Zeleza is Senior Advisor for Strategic Initiatives at Howard University. Previously, he was Associate Provost and the North Star Distinguished Professor at Case Western University, after serving as Vice Chancellor or President and Professor of Social Sciences and Humanities at the United States International University in Kenya. Professor Zeleza has worked in various academic institutions worldwide and has written extensively and is recipient of numerous awards from major universities for his scholarships. The full conversation with Dr. Paul Tiambe Zeleza will be on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Breeze and Soul by Kool and the Gang, as we continue to commemorate Black Music Month. That's it for Africa Now for today. Up next is Headline News, followed by Sha'anana with Zain Al-Amin, focusing on issues in the Middle East and Northern Africa, particularly the situation in Gaza. That's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by Human Rights and Justice with Nakichi Taifa. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Kombit Lakai with Eugenia Charles looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineer Michael Nicella. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Koza and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Utterson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and TU for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Grab Education by Steel Pulse. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
Something. As I was passing, I heard children laughing.
As I was passing, I heard children laughing.
At the schoolyard gate, I turned around and said,
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bengert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The D.C. Council gave final approval to the city's fiscal 2025 budget yesterday, and among the provisions was funding to create a task force for a study of reparations for black residents. The bill to create a task force was introduced by Councilman Kenyon McDuffie last year and has yet to be passed, but the inclusion of preliminary funding is a vote of confidence towards its passage. Under McDuffie's proposal, the task force would explore ways to deliver restitution to black residents harmed by generations of racism and institutional discrimination, starting with slavery, in a city that has some of the starkest racial wealth disparities in the country. Kenyan President William Ruto withdrew his support for a planned tax hike a day after the bill was passed by the country's legislature, responding to intense protests against the tax hike. Protesters yesterday stormed the Kenyan Parliament building, setting a portion of it on fire, and held demonstrations in major cities across the country. At least 23 people were killed and scores wounded, according to medical workers. Police fired live ammunition and tear gas at protesters in the capital, Nairobi. President Ruto is facing competing pressures from protesters and international lenders, including the IMF, which are urging deficit reductions in exchange for loans. In his televised address announcing the withdrawal of the tax hike, Ruto said he would embark on a dialogue with Kenyan youth without providing details. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange returned to his native Australia today, after pleading guilty in a court in the U.S. Mariana Islands to publishing U.S. military secrets. The plea deal resolves an over-decade-long legal dispute in which Assange faced life in prison for the publication of classified documents and other media, including an infamous video of U.S. soldiers shooting civilians, including two journalists, from a helicopter. An Assange lawyer said he spoke with Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, who had vocally advocated for Assange's return to Australia. In a statement, WikiLeaks thanked, quote, "all who stood by us, fought for us, and remained utterly committed in the fight for his freedom," end quote. In domestic news, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled today in favor of the Biden administration in a legal spat with GOP-led states over government powers to combat misinformation on social media. In a 6-3 decision, justices said GOP states suing the Biden administration had no standing, tossing out lower court rulings in favor of the states. GOP officials had argued White House staffers and federal agencies applied, quote, "unrelenting pressure" on social media platforms to suppress conservative viewpoints. The White House denied the accusation and said a ruling in favor of the GOP states would limit the government's ability to combat hate speech and engage with social media platforms on matters of national security, public health, and election integrity. Conservative Justices Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Clarence Thomas dissented. And President Biden pardoned what could be thousands of American veterans who were convicted of engaging in gay sex under a now-defunct article in the Code of Military Justice. The law, which had been on the books since 1951, was rewritten in 2013 to prohibit only forcible acts. The president said in a statement, quote, "Today, I am righting an historic wrong by using my clemency authority to pardon many former service members who were convicted simply for being themselves," end quote. The clemency action won't automatically change the recipient's criminal record. Those covered by the pardon will be able to apply to receive proof that their conviction has been erased, petition to have their discharges from the military upgraded, and move to recover lost pay and benefits. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 94 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 90 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington,